The Off the Ball Podcast Network. Leaders Questions with Ger Gilroy and Stuart Lancaster.
In association with Goal.
From Off the Ball.
All right, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. Our guest this week is Dr. Matt Morgan, and he is on Skype with us. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, very good. So I'm looking forward to this. Matt's an author. He's also a doctor in intensive care and has managed to explain exactly what that experience is like from his perspective and also from the other side of it as somebody who's involved with a patient in intensive care as well. What drew you to Matt first, Stuart?
I went on hold after the season finished, after the Pro 14 final. Typically, I took about 15 books and I picked Matt's book up, which is, I think it's just come out actually. I read that and I've started reading. I've always read lots of different leadership books. I read, you go through the sort of leadership / sporting biographies, then you read the business leadership books, and then I started reading books from on politicians, and I'm not particularly political if I'm being honest, but I'm interested in decision making under pressure, and then. I started reading one or two. There's more of these sort of books come out that have been written by doctors or heart surgeons or whatever, and I'm interested in their decision making that really is life and death, moments. Anyway, so I'd read a couple before, and I picked Matt's up, and it was also poignant in the fact that he's got various chapters in the book about how. What happens when you have a lung infection or a brain injury or a heart attack or whatever. And with my dad passing away this time last year, he had a cardiac arrest on the farm. And my mum amazingly managed to keep him alive, and he went to the ICU in Carlisle. And we went through the process that Matt described in his book of being that my dad lying there, the consultants come to speak to us. I was trying to work out what the right thing to do was, how best to help him, could we help him? He had a brain injury through lack of oxygen to the brain, and ultimately decisions to made to what kind of life would he want to lead. And, it was terrible. I mean, such a traumatic event for all of us, and my mum especially, because she was the one that saw him fall and tried to save him. Anyway, unfortunately, he passed away. And so I read it because I wanted a little more clarity in my mind about that, that piece of it really, and there was a chapter on that, and anyway, cut a long story short, I thought I'd really like to email him just to thank him for writing the book, because I thought it was a really good book, and it gave me a lot of sort of, it just helped me with the process, I guess, but within it he talked about how as a doctor he tries to be effective and sensitive and compassionate with parents and children and siblings and with people who are in the ICU or in that sort of life or death position. So I wanted to thank him for writing the book and say, it was something that I went through, and if I could ever help raise awareness of cardiac arrest or whatever else, then I'll try and help if I can, and also try and maybe pass on some feedback as to what it felt like to me, how consultants and doctors can maybe make you feel better when you're a patient, if you like, or the relative of a patient. Anyway, so that was the initial email, and Matt replied, and then I decided to invite him onto this, and so here we are. So we've not actually met physically. We've got a game in Wales. Matt's in Wales, so we've got a game in Wales in February. I think the first game's not until February, March. So I'll hopefully hook up with him, catch up with him then.
When you got the book, and we'll get to Matt in 1 minute. When you got the book, did you know this chapter was in it, or did you kind of discover it accidentally in the middle of it? You just thought, oh, this is going to be good.
I sort of flicked through it and realised there was a chapter on heart and brain injury, and. My wife sort of looked at me and said, geez, why are you reading about that on your holiday? You're bringing all those memories back. But maybe it's just my way of dealing with it, but also trying to understand it better. But also I was drawn to Matt's description of how he, as a doctor, has to deal with those really life or death conversations and decisions, in a sensitive and compassionate way, yet still make decisions. So I'm fascinated from a leadership point of view. He's evolution into becoming what he's become as a surgeon. Right, why write the book? What do you want to get out of the book? And et cetera, et cetera.
And the book's called Critical Sciences and Stories from the Brink of Life. Matt, how obviously exactly what Stuart has just spoken about is in the book. How did you decide to write this down? What was the impetus behind trying to get the story out there of what life is actually like at the coalface in the ICU when you're having the conversations that somebody had with Stuart's family?
Yeah, well, first of all, Stuart, thank you for being so open and honest and sharing that. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough thing to do, especially in terms of what you've been through. And really, that's exactly the reason why I did write it. I haven't always had a passion for writing or journalism. I spelt my name wrong in school. My spelling's still dreadful, actually. But one thing really struck me. I went to a medical conference maybe around 2 years ago, and I spoke at that conference. I spoke about a topic I knew well. It was well received. People said, well done. I went away feeling good about it. And that evening, which was in Dublin, actually, over a Guinness in a local bar, somebody said to me, why are you here? Why are you in our city? And I said, I'm at a conference. I'm a doctor. That's why I'm here. What do you do? I said, intensive care medicine. And they said, what's that? And it really struck me at that point. I've spent a decade of my life writing academic papers that hardly anyone reads, actually, and working on things all about the profession. And what I've forgotten about is the brother, the dad, the mum, the sister, the person at the end of that, and getting these messages across, just like Stuart has discussed. That's so important. Every time I meet a family in intensive care, it's the worst day of their life. That's my first meeting. And for them to process that and go away with all the answers when they're trying to deal with grief or shock is so hard. So I want something that somebody can take away and digest maybe later down the line, or even prepare them for what may come in the future, just as you've described.
It's almost like a textbook in some ways for people to deal with the situation that they really hope they never have to deal with.
Yeah, I guess it's predominantly about stories. And there is a flurry of medical memoirs out there at the minute, which I absolutely love all of them. This isn't really a memoir. It's not all about me. This is all about patient stories, real patient stories, and how the science integrates into that. There are elements of my life in there and how you deal with complaints and stress and grief and all those aspects. But really, I wanted to flip this book and make it not about the doctor writing it, but about the patients at the end of it.
Talk to us a little bit about that, will you? Because I know that medicine seems like such a cold thing, and in some ways it has to be, because you do see so many patients and you can't get emotionally involved with all of them because it just wouldn't be very good for your mental health. And yet at the same time, it's inevitable that at some point the personal stories of the people that you're dealing with will actually become part of who you are.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's advantages and disadvantages to that. It's not something you can choose or something you can switch off. But actually, talking about these threads that run through sports and medicine and other things, the more I've been thinking about it, actually, over the last few days, there are lots of comparisons in medicine. People sometimes compare it to being a pilot, where you have to go through checklists, or other professions. But actually, it's much like elite sport in many ways. We have a lot of training before events. We have simulation, much like the drills you do. But what's important is when you deliver that to a patient, to a family, and it works. Lives are saved. You score. You win the match. And at the same time, we are under pressure. There are crowds watching us, and they may be mums, dads, families, other colleagues. And also there's those human factors of working as a team. So I think the more I've been thinking about it, actually, there's some fantastic comparisons between medicine and elite sport. And I think we can probably learn a lot from each other, in fact.
I guess that's kind of why we're here today. The one thing that I would point out is that it's not a matter of life and death when you guys lose a game, despite what Bill Shankly was saying. I think Shankly was actually speaking tongue-in-cheek when he said that. I can see why you would be drawn to the those people who are under the types of pressures that Matt has just spoken about there, because the rest of us don't really experience those pressures on a day-to-day basis. But certainly if you're in the ICU, you are making, I think one of the stats in a piece that I read from Matt was that there's 16,000 different diagnoses possible when somebody walks in, and your brain has to compute exactly on the basis of sometimes quite flimsy evidence and quite quickly what the issue is.
No, it's huge respect for anyone going into the medical profession, for the complexity of the job, but also the complexity of the emotional and leadership decision making that you have to make, you know, on a daily basis and dealing with like full, you know, so to say, life and death situations. Remember, I was asked to go and do a talk it was part of the Leeds General Infirmary, and they had the night shift doctors and care team, if you like, finishing and the day shift starting, and they weren't working together really that well. And one of the surgeons, who happened to be a former rugby player, said, listen, could you come in just in that window and just talk to us about not working silos, how you work more collaboratively as a team, because some of the messages that we're transmitting from nighttime to daytime are getting lost in translation, or, you know, certain guy thinks this and certain person thinks that. So I went one morning at this 7:30 changeover window, and I sat and listened to the reports of what had happened overnight, traffic accident here, you know, broken leg there, you know. And it was mind-blowing, really, you know, what they were dealing with. And I then felt a bit of a fraud, really, trying to talk about sport and working in teams and everything else. But they actually really appreciated it, because I think sometimes in their world you can get lost in the complexity of it all. And actually, you know, the one thing I would say about my experience of the ICU was they were fantastic, but, you know, the subtle differences in communication style between four different consultants during the case of, it was like 8 or 9 days were big for us, were huge, you know.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
So, you know, one the first consultant would give you probably a slightly more optimistic view. So you latch onto that and you think, okay, so, you know, we just need to reduce the sedation and he'll come around. And then the next consultant on the next day, because obviously they were working different shifts and everything else, yeah, this isn't looking good. And you're there thinking, oh my God, you know, this is, what happens next? You know, and I wanted the information. You know, so then you go on the internet and you start searching for what's the answer here. And then we had a brain scan of my dad's brain, and, you know, that was traumatic in itself. My mum's beside me, and I've got two brothers and a sister, and you're managing all that. And then the youngest consultant, actually, of all, came in, and he actually spoke to us probably in the most compassionate way, but in the most informative way, to help us make the right next decision. And I remember vividly saying to him, if this was your dad, would you do this course of action if you were us? Would you do it? And he said, and I kept, because by that time I'd sent my mum out there, and I said, he said, I would. And actually that was the point where we made the decision to stop the life support, and nature took its course. But, you know, as Matt said, it's way beyond any sporting event, obviously, what we're talking about. You know, this isn't remotely comparable. But it was nice to be able for me to at least try and help a little bit. You feel like you're doing some good into their profession, you know, in the same way that if I was asked to talk once to a police force, and, you know, because they're doing the service. You know, the service that these doctors, nurses and people in ICU is phenomenal. And I would never be critical in the slightest at all. I think they're doing an amazing job. But to try and help out, you know, pass on what I'd learned was quite rewarding, actually.
Yeah, Matt, that's a really interesting dynamic that Stuart's talking about there, because obviously different people have different skills. And obviously the most important skill that anybody has in medicine is an understanding of what the issue is, what the possible treatment is, and what the range of outcomes are. But then after that comes their ability to communicate that to the next of kin and whoever else is going to be a decision maker, or indeed the patient, if the patient is able to take that information on board. When you're writing about this stuff, I'm not saying that there's an implicit criticism of some of your colleagues, but some of your colleagues might take it that way. Has there been any kind of sense of, oh, look, here comes Matt with his compassion and his knowledge, and why do I really need to read this, Matt?
Yeah, the bit I was most nervous about was how this book was going to be received by colleagues, patients, and families. It wasn't reviewers. It wasn't, you know, an Amazon review that I care about. It was how those patients, families, and colleagues receive it. And in fact, in the book launch, and I spoke in the Hay Book Festival as well, there were lots of patients and families who were actually in the book, physically there. And I rarely get nervous. I'm happy speaking. I've spoken in front of lots of people. But that, you know, that was a real clincher. That really, really got me. Just to pick up on two things Stu mentioned, which is so important. The most dangerous thing we do in medicine isn't how we use a knife or isn't what drug we use. It's what we do with our mouths. It's communication. That is the most important and also the most dangerous thing we do. And there's, you know, there's lots of sayings, what is said isn't heard, what's heard isn't understood, what's understood isn't done. And there's so much we can improve on in medicine as well as other industries through that means. And I think what Stuart's really getting to is sometimes it's difficult to say the most important three words in medicine. And they are, I don't know. And saying that as a doctor and hearing that as a family, especially when somebody's critically ill, is so hard. But the reality is, you know, is dad going to be okay? What's going to happen? Are things going to be okay? The truth is, a lot of the time, we don't know. Yes, we can give stats and percentages, just like the pundits and just like the bookies. But ultimately, the only thing we have, the simple thing we have, is time. And all the complexity of intensive care with machines and drugs and staff, all that does is give people time. Time to get better, time for us to find out what's wrong with them, and sadly, sometimes time for them to say goodbye.
I don't know. What is the issue, do you think, that so many people in your profession have with it? Is it because they're worried about the response from the patient and the patient's family? It's like, well, you're supposed to know, that's your job. Or is it, what is it? What is the gap between telling the truth about what the current situation is?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. You know, as doctors and nurses and physios and other professions, we've been brought up on the sciences. We may be, you know, we might have got great A-level grades. We love certainty. We like answering questions correctly. All the multiple choice questions in exams, you know, there's no option there saying, I don't know. You don't get points for that. So it's almost been brought up in that culture. And also, you know, with the internet and data, artificial intelligence, surely there's certainty out there for some things. But the reality is, you know, humans are so complex, medicine is so complex. Yes, we can give statistics, but the ultimate truth a lot of the time is I don't know.
That would have helped, I guess, at the start of your experience.
Yeah, I'm not saying my experience was, you know, it was a terrible experience, but I'm not saying anyone could have done anything differently. I admire everyone who came and spoke to us and tried to help us. It was excellent. I'm just interested to know. It's just such a tough job to do. I think that's why I was interested in Matt's book. You know, it's so difficult to be technically excellent in such a complex field, to have the answers to so many different things, and then also have the communication skills and the leadership skills to lead a group of nurses, to lead a group of other consultants, to, yeah, like I say, I think the skills required to be in that field vast. I'm interested in Matt's journey.
To get there,
yeah.
Yeah. Matt, doing a bit of reading before this, there's certainly you've written about a few key incidents in your life where early on in your career in medicine, I think it was a teenager on a gap year who went to Africa, ends up in your care. And that's a key moment, I think, in your decision to try and get to understand why things happen. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. So I met a guy called Chris, who I'll never forget. He was a 17-year-old student with the world at his feet. He's about to go off to Australia with some friends with school, and at the last minute changed his mind and decided, his friends changed their mind, to go to Africa, go to Kenya instead. His dad was never comfortable with this. He even tied a piece of red wool to the roof rack of the car and said, I'll only untie that, Chris, when you're home safely. He climbed up Mount Kenya. He helped children from the local slum climb up to the top of the mountain. His passion was education and children, actually. And when he got down, less than 24 hours later, he was critically unwell. He had severe lung infection, sepsis, and pneumonia. And I met him 6 weeks later in the intensive care unit, where he was still critically ill. Just a few days after his 18th birthday party, we'd had a cake on the unit and the candles were blown out. A few days later, I was in the room when his family were told that Chris was going to die. And for me, that changed me. It made me want to do intensive care as a career, and it made me want to try to answer the questions his family had asked. And those questions were, why him? Why did he get ill and nobody else did? Why didn't the treatments work? And what can we do to help others? I then did some research. I did a PhD in sepsis and infection, trying to answer some of those questions. And actually in the book, you know, there's photos of Chris there, and there's also there's a hidden song lyric in there, actually, which is Chris's favourite song. It's on page 62. Every other word of page 62 is a hidden lyric. Just don't tell the publishers. And the reason that's there is because even in these terrible situations, sometimes darkness can show you light. And in fact, in the years since Chris has died, there's been a school built in his name in Kenya, where there are now children go into who work in that very hospital that cared for Chris. There's a plaque on that school with his favourite song. And there's been a massive campaign led by numerous organisations, including the UK Sepsis Trust, to try to raise awareness of these issues of infection. So, you know, even though, yes, we see these dreadful things, we kneel in the grit with families at difficult times. Every time I go onto the intensive care unit, if I'm having a bad day or I've had a tax bill or my tire's flat in my car, you know, speaking to these families, that pales into insignificance and you realise that actually life is precious.
How do you harden yourself to that? It's completely the wrong question, but how do you allow yourself to continue not to be hardened by this?
Yeah, I can't say that perhaps you're not. And sometimes when my friends tell me they've, you know, hurt their ankle or they're ill in some ways, I'm probably not as compassionate as I should be. You know, sometimes I kind of don't care as much as perhaps I should. At the same time, I can't stand the sight of blood when my daughter's got a nosebleed. So it's not a simple answer. I think, you know, it self-selects a kind of person who, when they see these awful things, it makes you appreciate your own life, actually. So rather than delve into the darkness, it makes you appreciate that life is precious. And I think that's probably the way I deal with it. Not say there aren't times where I come home and I'm sad or I'm cross or I shout at the children or the dog because of something that's happened. You know, that happens. And burnout is a real issue in medicine, as it is, I'm sure, in elite sport, with the way coaches have to deal with failure and troubles. But, you know, there's ways in and around that.
Do you think your leadership skills, your communication skills have improved, you know, over time? And does the qualification to be a doctor prepare you, you know, to make leadership decisions, to be a good communicator, to have empathy, to have, you know, all those softer skills that are required to be an effective doctor, as well as obviously the technical skills?
Yeah, I think medicine has long had an apprenticeship model. So you do the training in the science and you know the chemistry and all that, and then you realise actually that's kind of less important, and it's all those other skills which are. And that's come through an apprenticeship model. There are now leadership academies, training courses, and more about that in medicine. But I think certainly looking towards the future, you know, as you guys have done with your leadership academies and the way it works in sport, we need to embrace that in a much more robust, structured way. You know, listening to the previous podcast here, when you put the words, the official words in, I can see where that happens in medicine. You know, I can see where you need to take an emotional response to the family, but then sometimes you need to just stand up in a resuscitation scenario make decisive decisions and be that decisive leader. I don't think we've got the language yet in medicine to talk about that and discuss that in a robust way, especially in clinical scenarios, although we have explored much more in terms of human factors over the last 5 to 10 years, and that's really come into medicine in a big way. But in fact, that work has been led not necessarily by clinicians, but by others. There was a pilot called Martin Bromley whose wife sadly died through a scenario which she shouldn't have died from. There was a complication in an operation. It's an easily fixable complication, relatively, but the people who had the skills at the time to fix it didn't fix it. And the reason for that was the way that they interacted with each other. And Martin, being a pilot, has thrown himself into this world and now has a human factors academy showing doctors, nurses and others how to work together. So I think, you know, there's lots we can learn from industries like Elite Sport, like other industries, really.
I was going to ask you about that. Just in terms of the review process, you know, it strikes me that the ICU that I was in, you know, the beds were full, and then one person was in a bed, and then another person came in the next day, and obviously, you know, it's so fast moving. You know, a traffic accident, something happens. Do you get time to pause and reflect and review effectively? You know, in sport, we'd play the game on Saturday. We'd have a review on the Monday morning, and then we put that to bed. We take the learning. We move on to the next game on the following Saturday. But you know, you've got a lot more than one game a week.
Yeah, that absolutely has to happen. And the truth is, most of the time, it doesn't in any structured way. What we do review, of course, are when things go wrong. You know, that's part of the complaints process. We have a root cause analysis. Everything is looked at in detail. But of course, you can learn things when things have gone wrong. But equally, you learn things hugely when things have gone right.
Yeah.
I've also found that since writing the book and going back to visit patients at home, now that's really tied that circle together for me. It's not something normally we can do. You know, in the prior, a success or an outcome was an empty bed. And an empty bed means either somebody's better or somebody's died. And that's not what follow-up should be. You know, follow-up should be exactly as you've described, you know, looking at it in detail. What can we learn? What can we do better? How can we interact better? And why isn't that there? It's pressure of time. It's pressure of resource. And it's also, you know, I think we have to break those models and sometimes talk to experts and talk to others like you guys to try to bring aspects like that in.
Mm. Matt, this seems like a really important way of thinking about medicine, pardon me, and something that actually the entire industry could learn from. Are you finding now, so we talked earlier on about the you were worried about the response. Has the response been decision makers thinking, actually, I need to read this and we need to have this conversation? Is this starting a conversation for you?
Yeah, certainly. When I go to public events and when I go to book festivals, I'm going to the Bali Book Festival in October, which is going to be a fantastic ability to discuss with other regions around the world. There's the Krakow Book Festival coming up, actually. I've been asked to speak at a couple of non-healthcare events, which is really important. So it's absolutely started the conversation. One big initiative which is started now, partially through the chapter in the book about a lady called Lauren Connolly, who is a lady from Scotland who sadly died through a road traffic accident. She was a junior doctor, working long hours, not resting enough because of those long hours, and sadly died on the busiest motorway in Scotland. And her dad has started a remarkable campaign to try to bring in the importance of sleep, rest and fatigue into medicine, especially in the UK, along with other Royal Colleges and other people. So, you know, this is, I think, the way into this. And the thing that will make the most difference, you know, isn't that new fancy drug or that new fancy machine. It's things like this podcast has talked about changes in leadership, changes in the way we rest and sleep and learn from mistakes.
There's so much to learn from other industries for sport as well. Is sport open to listening to stuff generally, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most enlightened and the best sporting leaders I've come across, they are relentlessly looking for, you know, lessons they can learn. I mean, it's interesting, Matt, speaking about the aviation world, I can't help but think about Jim Gavin. I don't know if you were thinking the same thing at the same time. You know, over here, Matt, the Dublin GAA football team is run by a coach, Jim Gavin, who works in the aviation world, and he spoke to us at Leinster about the principles he's applied, the lessons he's learned from the aviation world, and there's no doubt that, you know, we took a huge amount from that. I mean, I think, you know, like I say, the best sporting leaders will always seek out others. But I think...
That's fairly recent, I would suggest, is it? The last decade.
Without a doubt. But also, I think that the... there's something sport can give back as well, I think, in terms of, like I say, that example of me talking to the, you know, the NHS in Leeds, the General Infirmary, you know, that was a great example.
It's an exterior view, really. It's like people who are undergoing all processes, all businesses, all functioning societies run on a bunch of different processes that are fundamentally human interactions, and how we can improve those human interactions. If somebody from outside comes and has a look and says, you're doing that a little bit wrong, have you tried this? Every business, every hospital, every school, every radio station, every media company can always improve from these things. And it seems like it's a very straightforward thing. We just need to be open to the learning.
Yeah, open for learning. Make the time for learning. It strikes me that in the medical world, you know, time is so squeezed. You can be thinking, right, well, we're not too bad today, and suddenly the whole landscape changes in 1 hour because of three different things have happened at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's true. Matt, I think that both yourself and Stuart are enlightened versions of people in your industry. There is the cliche of the hard-bitten old coach who would have been like, I have nothing to learn. And it's the same in medicine, certainly. We've all seen the God complex consultants of Hollywood, essentially, that has, you know, the cliche has passed into popular culture. It seems like there's a new generation of people who are willing to listen and learn and hopefully implement very significant changes that will have massive impact on how we practice medicine as a society.
Yeah, there's still huge challenges. I think you're right. Things have changed from, you know, decades ago with those, you know, big bullshit characters, my way or no way. I think things have changed. There are still big challenges. And we've still got big issues with discrimination and gender parity in medicine. That's a huge issue, not only in my specialty of intensive care, but in many other specialties. That's a big challenge. Learning from mistakes and really having a no-blame culture is a massive thing. Now, there was recently a court case of a doctor in training who was prosecuted for manslaughter, actually, when a poor young chap died of infection, died of sepsis. But actually, there's a litany of problems in and around the place in which she was working. Understaffing, IT failures, lack of staff on the rotor. There's a huge element of that. And I think medicine really needs to stand up and, you know, having a no-blame culture where we can learn from problems and not only prosecute problems is a huge way forward. You know, I don't know how far sport has gone in terms of that. There still seems to be, you know, there's always a person, perhaps at fault, and hence they move on or don't move on. But often, you know, I would argue that the reason that the result is X or Y, you know, it's so false to say that that's one person. You know, this is the system, this is the training, this is the pressure it's under.
Yeah, I'm laughing.
Serendipity,
I'm laughing because this is exactly the conversation we had off air before we started today. Stuart was giving out about the quality of analysis. Saying that.
No, I was talking generally about the media, how they narrow it down to one person and one thing. And as Matt has just said, it's never one person and one thing. It's a litany of reasons that victory or defeat takes place. The media like to narrow it down to, it's because of this.
A single narrative.
Or a single person.
Yeah.
And or sometimes a coach or sometimes a player. And it's never that. And then, like, that's how my wish, if you like, I would hope that the likes of you guys, you know, you get, let's talk about the detail of the result and why the result happened rather than just the result.
Fair enough. On that note, Matt, I wish you every success with the book. It's called Critical Sciences and Stories on the Brink of Life. And you can follow Matt on Twitter. It's at Dr. Matt Morgan. Thanks very much for being part of Stuart's Leaders Questions this week.
Thanks, both.
Cheers, Matt.
Cheers. Thank you.
So that was good. What's the best bit of homework that we could all do to become better analysts, Stuart?
For you guys?
Yeah.
Do you watch the game back?
Some games, yeah. So it depends, right? So we've got to watch soccer games, rugby games, football games.
Yeah.
It's you pick the ones that you watch back. So I'll watch the Highland Cup games back, and I'll watch the.
I think as analysts, not you necessarily, because you're not actually the analyst. You're the guy asking the analyst the question. Yeah. But I'll be quizzing the analyst on. Okay, can you tell me some of the reasons why the victory occurred or the defeat occurred, and I want to understand it from a technical and tactical point of view, you know, so that you're getting into the detail of the reasons why an incident happened rather than just narrow it down to, well, obviously they're rubbish because they lost.
Yeah, fair enough. Stuart, good stuff. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Leaders Questions with Ger Gilroy and Stuart Lancaster.
In association with Goal.
From Off the Ball.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.